Hey everyone, this is John.
This is Warriors.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show 64, the best in Nintendo podcast on the internet. And like the name implies, we're going to talk about Nintendo 64 games. Or Nintendo 64 game, as the case is on this particular show. But we're going to talk about anything retro.
So we have a we actually have a game to talk about.
We do.
Oh,
we
wow.
Do. And from here until about May or June, we will have a N64 game to talk about every month. And then after June, you know, we're pretty much just vamping. We're probably going to rely a lot on the Game Boy Advance until the GameCube comes out.
I mean, most of these shows, most of the time, taken up by non-game related things.
It's true. It's slim pickings to find. Like, we're super late in the Game Boy life cycle. Where like the N64 never got the supportive software that we saw on the Super Nintendo. So, you know, we're grasping for topics here. However, we got a good one. And what we do is we peer back in time. We take a look back 21 years ago, semi-chronologically. So we are going back to February of 2001. And you guys, what a time to be alive.
God, no, that it was.
We had everything figured out.
The Grand Society.
Everything was going to be great. Mm. Nothing was ever going to go wrong.
Oh, yeah. Coca-Cola came out of the water fountains. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a dream.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So the main topic is for the N64 is going to be Paper Mario, and there's also a Game Boy Color game, Mega Man Extreme, that actually came out in January. I missed it last month, but backtracking a little bit to talk a little bit about this non-consequential Game Boy Color game. But yeah, and then we have at least a movie to talk about, as well as a little bit of music.
Yes.
We might do a little bit.
Movie?
Yep, one movie.
Just the one, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A couple to mention that did come out, but were not good enough to watch.
Oh. For anyone, ever.
Yeah.
Never again.
No, never watch these other movies. But, where do you guys want to start? You want to start with Paper Mario or Mega Man Extreme?
I'll let you lead the way.
Oh, oof.
Well, we usually start off with the N64, so let's give the Game Boy Color a little bit of time here. So Mega Man Extreme, of course, published and developed by Capcom. That releases on the Game Boy Color in North America in June of 2010. So
let's not dance around the topic.
Sorry, January of 2001. Goddamn.
Just up front, is the game Extreme?
No, not really.
Oh.
So, but
it's pretty bland.
But, you know, like this was, you know, a time when Extreme was a buzzer. Well, a lot of people like associate Extreme and like that sort of snotty attitude type thing with the 90s, but it really bleeds over into the early 2000s as well, because you know there's Mega Man Extreme, there's an ongoing X-Men book that starts up around this time called X-Men Extreme. So, you know, the extremeness of the 90s doesn't like go away at the start of the millennium. It hangs around for a bit. It
sure does.
Am I looking at this right? Because I YouTubed it,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like I'm fighting Chill Penguin.
Yeah, you sure are. So what Mega Man Extreme is it's a sort of remix, demake of the Super Nintendo Mega Man X and Mega Man X2 games.
Because that's what everybody asked for, is demakes.
Right. And that's where Capcom decided to go with the Game Boy Color in January of 2001. And it is very strange with how this is like how they decided to approach what to put on the platform next, because rather than like make original content, rather than like trying to bring over some ports of like the original like NES Mega Man games, which have probably been like cleaner to bring over onto a Game Boy Color. They went with these sort of smaller screens, so less screen real estate, pixel graphic, NES-style Mega Man X games, and like the stages are nearly identical. There are like power-ups you find in different places. Mm-hmm. Rather than taking on 8 Robot Masters, you take on 4. Like I think the first 3 are from Mega Man X, and then 1 is from Mega Man X2, and then you go through like these, there's a couple like little interstitial fights, and then you like of course go through the Wily Castle. And the weird thing about this game is when you finish it, you can basically like continue on with the game, and they call it hard mode. It's not really a harder mode, it's just you get more stuff. So they change up, rather than fighting the same 4 Robot Masters again, they give you 4 different ones. But it's not like you, and of course there's stages associated with them, but it's not like you fight those four different ones and then go through like a different end game. You pretty much play through the same end game in both modes. So it's just a strange way of breaking up the game where you have like a first segment where you fight the four robot masters and then you fight the final boss. And then if you continue on in, you know, hard mode in quotes, you play through four different ones and then play through the same end game again. And then if you beat all that, you can play through, I forget what they call it, the extreme mode or something, where you have to beat all eight robot masters and then go through the end game, which is really like how all Mega Man games had been working up to that point. I'm not sure why they chose to sort of splice this thing up. An A side and
a B side to it.
Right, and then...
Is there a way to skip, say you've already beaten the A side, do they like give you a code at least to say like, hey, I'd want to pick up at the B side, or pick up at the last four bosses?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure if this game uses like hard saves or if it's a password system, but I would have to assume that if it does, like a lot of Mega Man games use a password system, you can probably just put in a password to skip to, you know, the mode you want to get to, yeah. Or if it's using saves. Because what it does is it allows you to continue from where you left off. And like even so, like some progress will carry over. So of course, if you're playing through normal mode and you get all your power-ups, when you go into that B side of hard mode, everything carries over with you, including like the robot master powers that you got, any sort of upgrades to your health or energy tanks will carry over with you. So, you know, hard mode is a bit of a misnomer because you're like further powered up by the time you get to the end game than you were even on like just the standard like normal mode in quotes.
This is dumb.
Yeah, it was a really strange choice because they try to achieve the same visual style. You know, they got some decent-looking Game Boy pixel graphics,
yeah.
But you're not working with the same screen real estate. So, you know, there are a lot of times you end up taking damage from something that's going to come in from off-screen very quickly.
Well, let's be clear. Like at the same time that this game is coming out, right, you also have three different versions of the same Powerpuff Girls game, and you've got a Dexter's Laboratory game that are just garbage.
It's true. It's true.
This is probably the thing...
They made an effort.
Yeah.
They made an honest effort to bring over Mega Man X-style games to Game Boy Color.
I like that we're doing a podcast on a retro show in which we're talking about a game that is itself supposed to be a retro cart of a game that came out, like, what, 10 years prior or something?
What was Mega Man X? Mega Man X was probably...
Like 7 or 8 years
ago. We already talked about it.
Yeah, it must have been early 90s, because that's when the Game Boy, or sorry, Super Nintendo launched. So yeah, we're looking at a game that's probably close to 10 years old. And then they decided to make a worse, graphically speaking, version of it.
I can't wrap my head around that. I mean, I guess it's because we're living in an age right now where they're pretty much, let's remake these old games, and we're getting flooded with these. I never heard someone de-resing a game.
There are, you know...
doing this, especially with, like, the first four set is three bosses from Mega Man X and then one box from X2. You're like, what the like, this doesn't... Well, are we picking these random ass?
These sort of demakes do exist. A lot of them are fan projects at this point. Like, there are fan projects to remake games, such as some like a Metroid 2. But there's also like fan projects that will like make Ocarina of Time in an NES style, or make like Pokemon Sword and Shield.
It's a fan make thing. But like a major company is like, you know, Capcom's like, let's just take this game that works and runs great with what we got right now, and then just
make it difficult
because it's more difficult because
it'd be really out of character for a game company like Capcom now to take Monster Hunter and like, okay, let's make Monster Hunter as if it was running on a Game Boy Advance. Like that
would be really interesting.
Yeah, that sort of thing is
see how they can do that shit.
No longer the norm. You know, it's and a lot of times these sort of demakes would only exist even back in 2001, going from a console game down to a portable game, because the portable versions, especially working on the Game Boy, are not nearly as technically impressive as what you're doing on a console. But yeah, we're a lot of Capcom content on the Nintendo recently, because we had Mega Man Legends last month, now Mega Man Extreme. There's a couple of Zelda games coming out that Capcom made. Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons. We're going to talk about those in a few months. Those are real good.
Okay.
But yeah,
Mega Man. I played a bit Seasons, but no, Ages.
Ages no, maybe real Seasons. Good. I like both of them. I like Ages better, though.
Both I don't know, it was so long ago, I could not tell you the difference.
So, this Mega Man Extreme game, you can't get it on any sort of download service. The only way to play it is on the cartridge or, you know, through, let's say, less than optimally ethical means.
No, yeah.
I don't think Capcom's going to come at you for this one. No, fuck.
They'll be like, oh yeah, that game.
Well, good job, you found it.
So, the other game...
They'll be like, oh, you bought that new Contra game, huh? Sure got you there.
That's Konami.
Oh, that's Konami, that's right.
Paper Mario. Paper Mario comes out on the N64 in February of 2001... And this is a Mario RPG from Intelligent Systems. They make games like Fire Emblem. They continue making Mario games, Advance Wars. They've had a partnership with Nintendo. They're not outright owned by Nintendo, but they've had a partnership with Nintendo for quite some time, making all these franchises that are very closely associated, if not directly owned by Nintendo. So, and this game kind of has a funny sort of urban legend at point about it. You know, it's not like,
have you played during a full moon, he'll come out of the TV and murder you?
No, nothing like that, but the sort of like inception around how the game came to be. Like, there's talks of trying to make a new Mario, not really sure what direction to go with it, and a guy who's just like an artist at Nintendo was doodling something like in the lunchroom, and Miyamoto, he's like drawing Mario as if he's like a 2D piece of paper, and Miyamoto sees it and is like, yes, let's make a game like that, and then he becomes the lead artist on the game. Now, how much truth is there to that?
I don't know. Not much, I bet. That doesn't...
But it's the sort of like rags to riches sort of story that you want to root for, but is it entirely true? The people telling that story might be viewing the past through some rose-colored glasses. But this is not a sequel, but continuing the spirit of Mario RPG, which we talked about on the Super Nintendo show several years ago at this point. It has a lot of the same elements of Mario RPG, things like turn-taking battles, and you have a partner in battle that's going to help you fight. It doesn't have a full party system like Mario RPG had a 3-member party system. This you only have Mario and the partner character.
I missed those two. Was it March?
Mallow and Gino.
Mallow and Gino.
Bowser and Peach join up as well.
Yeah, but you never see those other two.
Well, Peach, like in Mario RPG, takes like your healer role, which isn't super necessary because the game isn't very difficult, and Bowser's more of your tanky character. So if you're just going for like purely offense, like especially with Mallow, because Mallow's your mage. So if you're just going for pure offense, then those are, you know, that's your primary party.
No, I was making the comment that outside of that game, we don't see them. They never reuse those two, Mallow and Gino.
Mallow and Gino, now Gino makes cameos every here and there. Like he made an appearance in like a puzzle game, and now there's a costume in Smash where you can make your Mii fighter into Gino, which is hilarious. That's
pretty cool. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's especially cool because people really wanted to see like the full Gino character, and
oh, you would have been great in Smash.
But then they're like, oh yeah, costume. You get a costume. That's all you got.
For your Mii fighter.
Yeah, it was like, fuck. Fantastic troll. Well done. But neither of them were in Paper Mario. But instead you get like these partner characters. They're like traditionally enemies, a lot of them. You get like a Goomba and a Koopa and a Bob-omb. And alongside like their participation in battle, they also help you with things just around the environment, like little puzzle solving or traversal type things. So things like if there's a switch across a gap that you can't get, you kick the Koopa shell, it activates the switch, it extends a bridge. Or if there is a crack in a wall, you send out your bomb buddy and she explodes, she self-destructs, and that you never see her again. But then there's, you know, a gap so you can get your extra few coins that is totally worth sacrificing her life. So. Oh God. One of the things that also differentiates these sort of Mario RPGs is a sort of active time executions, like in battle. So, you know, if you jump and attack an enemy, if you press the button at the right time, you know, you get an extra little chip damage in there as well. Or they do different things, like if you're going to hit them with a hammer, you pull on your analog stick back until it indicates to let go, and then you let go and it does a bit of extra damage for you. And it's going to be the case of all of your maneuvers in a fight, including your partner characters. Your partner characters don't have the same like sort of breadth of options of attack. They're pretty much going to have like a their main attack and maybe a couple of different skills that are basically the same thing but powered up and it costs you some MP. Mario has a couple of different ways of attacking. He's got his jump, his hammer. He's got items that he can use in battle, things like power blocks or fire flowers, things of that sort, HP restoring items. The game definitely has a difference of scale as well. With a lot of RPGs around this time, you're starting to get that bloat where, you know, your basic attacks are doing hundreds of damage right from the start. Whereas through most of Mario RPG, your basic attacks are only going to do a couple of damage. And you're not fighting these big, massive fights against bosses with thousands of HP. Most things are going to be over pretty quickly. It's not a particularly difficult game. I don't think it was meant to be. I did play this one. Recently, I started playing through it again. I didn't get very far. It's broken up into chapters. There's like 7 chapters. And every time you like complete a chapter, you get like a new like superpower. And you build up a meter to use the superpower. It kind of works like a summon. And one of the first ones you get is just a one that restores a bunch of HP. I like the battles, like as you get further into game, they get some increased complexity with what types of enemies are showing up in the fight, and they're like either vulnerable to only certain types of things. Like some enemies fly in the air, so if you try to use a hammer, you're going to whiff. And some enemies have like a little spike on top of their head, so if you try to use a jump, you're going to end up hurting yourself. And some enemies will stand in line, so they're vulnerable to your Koopa shell character using one of his moves to hit them all in a row. And doing things well in a fight, like hitting your timing attacks, well, will help fill up your meters faster to use your super attacks. So it all synergizes pretty well. And the game is broken up into chapters, and so it's kind of level-based. It's not really like the sort of like same open scale as you would see in a lot of RPGs of that era, like on the PS1. You have this like open like world map that you're going around and finding your different dungeons that you're going into. It's just more of here's the area you're in now, just kind of head in that direction along the screen, left to right. There's a couple of like a little side things that you'll do as you go along, like things to collect. But overall, very straightforward. Another little... a little bit of flair to the game is you have these badges that you can equip, and these badges will give you things like anything from like a special attack, give you a buff to just your regular attacks, that sort of thing. And you have like a pool of points that you can use to equip these passive skills onto yourself. And as you level up, you can gain more of those and equip more of these passive skills onto yourself. But yeah, I mean, I dare say, like, this is a pretty nice-looking N64 game. Not something that we say a whole lot. But, you know, it's low-res on the N64, but, you know, you up-res this game, and still, it holds up decently well, because it's got such a, like, simple, specific art style to it.
Yeah, actually, it looks really nice. And again, it looks like it's not so tethered down to the whole, like, blocky polygon thing. It looks like they get to have a little bit more character and fun with the art, even if, yeah, like you're saying, it is kind of simple. Mm-hmm. At least it looks good. The color palette looks really nice, and the art style's nice.
Yeah, yeah. They don't have to make a game that sort of revolves around having to navigate the 3D space. I mean, you still are navigating 3D space, but because you're, like, a 2D character moving around in this, it's not like they're having to, like, you're not shifting camera angles or anything. It's just a flat visual plane that you're looking at.
Like 2.5D?
Yeah, whatever. Sort of. You know, yeah, yeah. Kind of. This game originally came out in February of 2001, and I think it was in 2007 or 8 it came out on the Wii Virtual Console.
Super Paper Mario?
No. The Super Paper Mario was a sequel.
Oh, yeah. See, there in 2004, you get one called Thousand Year Door.
Yeah, that's the first sequel. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then Super Paper Mario after that. Mm-hmm. So you're saying this version was ported to one of the
under Virtual Console and Wii.
Oh, okay.
Which is where I originally bought it. I think there was a Club Nintendo promo at the time where I just exchanged some coins to get it, so I pretty much got it for free. Never played it, this version that I bought around 2007 or 2008. And then when the Wii U came out, for a little while they had this thing where, you know, you can pretty much exchange your Wii Virtual Console game for a Wii U version of that Virtual Console game. They charge you like $1.50 for an N64 version. So I did that. So I have it on the Wii U Virtual Console, and I just got around to playing the Wii Virtual Console version of this game about a week ago. So a game that I originally bought in 2007, I first started playing in 2022.
That's funny.
That sounds about right. Yeah. I have a few games that have just been sitting there for a while for just waiting.
In the wrapper still.
For that day.
But I did dabble with this one a little bit on the N64 way back in the day. I don't think I have a copy anymore. And a copy of this game, I think, goes for like $40-$50. So it's not cheap. I think that a virtual console, if you got a Wii U, is a good way to play this game because you can get the off-TV play going on the gamepad there. You get your save states, which is nice. And actually, this one also came out on the Switch expansion pass, the N64 one, I think, in December or January. So it is available there as well, which is nice because that would even have like Rewind. I don't think you'd ever need a Rewind with this particular game, but it is there if you want it. I think portable is a good way to play this game. And I'd be hard pressed to recommend paying $40 or $50 for a cartridge of any N64 game at this point, because there's so many new games that you should be spending your money on instead.
Yeah, like Pokemon Arceus.
Like Pokemon Arceus.
Yeah.
Which is a delight.
That's the first thing that popped my head.
Yeah. Or
get the new for Horizon coming out.
That looks pretty cool. Soon.
Ugh. You haven't played the other one yet.
No, I haven't.
I need to lend that to you because...
I haven't.
Oh, you have it?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was like a PlayStation Plus free download.
Oh, cool.
1 month. So I was like, yeah, I'll take that.
Do you have PlayStation Plus?
No, like anyone who had it wasn't like anyone who had a PlayStation could just download it.
Oh, okay.
A PS4.
Okay.
Which I do. So no, I have it.
Cool.
It looks cool.
It's really good.
I'll get to it at some point.
It's really good. I like that game a lot.
But you know, we got Xenoblade and Zelda allegedly this year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then Elden Ring's coming out.
Elden Ring looks cool.
Yeah, I'm going to be playing that.
So we've got River City Girl Zero as well.
Oh, God. I hate you so much for making me play that.
I didn't make you do anything.
I feel like you did. I feel like we've been judged. What made you go through this alone?
So, yeah, those are the N64 games. The N64 game and the Game Boy Color game. I have not looked up what's out next month, but I think we do have another N64 game as well as a Game Boy Color game for the next retro show. But it might be Pokemon Stadium. Oh, I might be talking out of class there. But
I have that.
That one's coming up pretty soon.
I can bring it over.
Or I think it's Pokemon Stadium 2.
Oh.
The second one.
Well, never mind. I got nothing.
That's okay. I'm sure it's very similar. Maybe this one works with like gold, silver.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Ryan, you had a PC game that you thought was worth mentioning.
Yeah, just a quick shout out.
Yeah.
There is a horror first-person shooter game that came out called Clive Barker's Undying. As you can imagine, it was made by Clive Barker.
He had no idea.
Yeah, he's a famous horror writer. This was kind of, I mean, this feels very much like it's in the...
They didn't tell him. They just gave out the game. Yeah. Put him in it. He's like, what the fuck am I in this game?
Should we just start attributing random things to Clive Barker? Clive Barker's Paper Mario.
That would be nice. Well, he's very heavily involved in this because not only did he write it, he is as I understand, he's a voice actor in it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So
did he credit himself as Clive Barker's Clive Barker?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, that would have been so good.
That would have been nice, wouldn't it? Apparently, this was developed by EA Los Angeles, which was a short-lived studio that was under the umbrella of EA Games.
In typical EA fashion.
Yeah.
Get them and close them.
Splintered this group off. They worked on this, and apparently it's like Command & Conquer games and stuff like that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
They did a thorough job of destroying Command & Conquer around this time.
Yeah. This game, I remember playing it back in the day. I don't really have that much to say about it other than the fact that I remember enjoying it at the time, as I did a lot of these other first-person shooters. I think this one's different in that it really is trying to go for this, like, feature film narrative. Like, it is still very much this first-person shooter horror experience where you're dealing with, like, this guy who is being called back to a man, like, this desolate mansion by his friend, where all of his siblings have supposedly been killed. And then you sort of just go on this whole story where you're trying to solve this Lovecraftian murder mystery. And it does a lot, like, there's a game called Blood, which was well before this, but Blood had this fun habit of using unconventional items as weaponry, and this game does the same. So it's sort of like, in one hand you'll have a pistol, but in the other hand you'll be casting spells. So not that many weapons, so it's not really supposed to be about this, like, you're in an arena with 50 things that need to die. It's much more you taking on more powerful things, a fewer number of more powerful things that are there with the intent to scare you. It's good. I mean, I watched a little bit of gameplay of it, and absolutely, I just remember this roller coaster ride of a game being a lot of fun. It was really, really enjoyable to play, especially against your more kind of like grindy first-person shooter experience where you just get a bajillion guns with 1,000 rounds and you just got to murderize everything. This one's actually got some atmosphere and an interesting story and pretty good voice acting too. And if anyone wants a real deep dive on it, there's a guy called Grimbeard that made like a 50-minute video talking about everything about this game, from a background on Clive Barker to the narrative of the game, what the game is actually like, and is it good? You know, his conclusion is that yes, it's very good, and it's always mine. This is a good game, so people should play it.
Why in this shot here there's like this smoky outline on the, is that the whole game like that?
No, I think that you're just like in kind of this, you have like this special like energy power that lets you like travel through this world.
I just saw it.
Travels in and out. Yeah, I mean, this game's got a lot going on for it being kind of,
it looks pretty good for the time. Yeah
this
does look pretty good, like visually, the graphics and everything like that. There's a pretty good depth going on here.
So again, that's all I'll say. Good stuff. Shotgun. Worth checking out.
There's one other thing about Paper Mario that I wanted to address.
Clive Barker, jog your memory.
Clive Barker's Paper Mario.
Yep.
So in some Paper Mario games, and really at this point, the majority don't do this, but in games like Paper Mario Thousand Year Door, Super Paper Mario, like the concept that you are a piece of paper factors a lot more into the gameplay. So I mentioned in Paper Mario 64, you have these partner characters and they help you sort of break down your roadblocks in order to progress in a level. Whereas in games like Thousand Year Door, they do this as well, but also there are things where you know turn sideways, and because you have turned sideways, you are now super skinny. You can get through more narrow spaces. There are things like you fold yourself into a paper airplane and allows you to glide over large gaps. And it's not something that's really in Paper Mario N64. It's more of just a visual aesthetic. So it's as this series continues, they do evolve that concept of being paper and how that factors into gameplay. And they'll also move away from the more like RPG elements, for example, like the turn-taking, like party-based battles. They'll move further away from that as the series goes on.
But into more like action-adventure kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Platforming?
Yeah, it becomes more of like an adventure platformer. And what'll end up happening is they'll try to mix in different things into these turn-taking fights that introduce like an element of randomness or item consumption. So in Color Splash, you do have turn-taking fights, but all of your actions are represented by a deck of cards. And it's not really a deck-building card game. You do have a collection of cards, but they're consumable. So whenever you get into a given fight, it is conceivable that you will run out of attack cards, in which case you just kind of have to let yourself lose. So you always have to make sure you're well stocked on your battle commands in that game. And in the most recent one, Origami King, also it does have like a turn-taking battle, but it's more based on like rotation and positioning rather than doing things like leveling up and gaining new skills. The sort of our really basic RPG mechanics of gaining experience by winning fights and leveling up and gaining new skills kind of goes by the wayside because there's another Mario RPG series, Superstar Saga, that's a more portable handheld series that I think starts in 2002, maybe 2003 on the Game Boy Advance, and that kind of takes the torch of the Mario RPG series. So the powers that be at Nintendo kind of see it as redundant to have two different Mario RPG series going on. So as Superstar Saga continues, Paper Mario becomes less of an RPG. But anyway, that's for the future. That's not for now.
Mm-hmm. The not too distant future, though, 2004, apparently.
Superstar Saga?
That's when Thousand Year Door comes out.
Yes.
2004. So
yes, yes, yes. So, movies?
Yeah.
Let's do it. Movie.
Break into or really a movie is what we have to talk about.
Where were all the movies?
The only ones that I wrote down, there were a handful that looked like they
could be a thing.
Made an impact at the box office, but the two big ones were Down to Earth, which is a Chris Rock comedy that he co-wrote, yes, as he does a lot of his movies with Louis C.K.
Where he dies and takes the body of a rich white man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I actually made an attempt to watch. It's not streaming anywhere. It wasn't available to rent on Amazon. I like had to, in order to watch it, you had to like subscribe to some obscure streaming service. I was like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah. I watched this a few times when I was younger because...
What else are you
I don't
watch?
Know. I had...
You watch Down to Earth and the Scooby-Doo movie?
I wouldn't watch it nowadays.
Well, I think when you have that or Pootie Tang to watch, you go Pootie Tang.
That's the fuck is Pootie
Tang? You guys never heard of this? You guys never seen it?
Well, I think, to your point, yes and...
And yes.
I think that there's probably a good, like, 51% of all movies ever made, if it's between that 51% or Pootie Tang, you go Pootie Tang.
Yeah.
I think, like, Pootie Tang is a very, like, very good, like, median...
Yeah. Right at the center of everything.
Yeah.
You know?
It's Pootie Tang.
It's a touchstone in filmmaking.
Yeah.
They teach us that in school.
You know that
in filmmaking school, they teach you Pootie Tang is the 51%.
Yeah, you watch Citizen Kane, yeah, and Casablanca and The Maltese Falcon and Pootie Tang.
Yeah. No, Pootie Tang is like a comedy. It's like a blaxploitation comedy that Louis C.K. and Chris Rock wrote and Louis C.K. directs. And it's like about this guy who just speaks in jive the whole time, but he's like this good guy hero you're following around. It's delightful. It's really, really funny. It's got some incredible gags. Some of the times you're watching this movie, you're like, what the fuck's going on here? Why is this happening? Like, some of the gags are just brilliant. Like, there's this great one where, like, so Chris Rock is his dad, as I remember correctly. Isn't he his biggest dad?
That sounds about right. It's been years since I've seen this.
Yeah, and the dad's talking about how he was injured at the factory. And then they cut to this clip of him at the factory, and he's, like, sweeping up the floor, but you can see above him, like 15 feet in the air, is this giant box. And he's like kind of slowly moving under it. And then right when he gets under the box, a gorilla comes off screen and starts beating him up.
I knew it would be something like that. I knew it.
It's like, what a great... Like, again, the movie is loaded with those kind of moments. So I would... I don't know why we're talking about Pootie Tang.
Yeah, why?
That is a good Chris Rock comedy.
We're moving on from Clive Barker's Pootie Tang.
Clive Barker's Pootie Tang, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but so...
Because Down to Earth was the actual movie that came out.
I didn't even watch a trailer for this thing. I didn't want to look it up. But the reviews basically said that it's sort of like they took all the fun out of Chris Rock. Like, he doesn't get to really be himself, I guess, because he's being a rich white guy in it, as you're describing the premise.
Yeah, he dies, but he wasn't supposed to die, so the angel's like, you're not supposed to be here, so they stick him in. There's like this weird scene where they're trying out different bodies, and he's saying no. The last one is this rich white guy, so he's takes that body for a little while. The ending was weird, because I don't really remember much of this, because it's been over 10 years since I've seen this thing, but the ending... The rich white guy, and like he finds happiness as him and everything like that, finds a woman that he loves and everything, and then some dude comes out of nowhere and shoots him. Like, they, and so he dies again, and they pull him in another guy's body, and except this time when he goes in that body, that was going to be his permanent body, and he would be that person now, and so he loses all sense of identity and becomes that guy.
Oh, weird.
And so he has no idea that he is Chris Rock.
That he's died twice.
Yeah, he's now that guy who died. So essentially, there's two of that guy now.
Interesting. Okay.
It's a weird movie.
That's kind of a downer of an ending.
It's just, it's the whole joke of this is a rich, fat, white guy is acting like a black guy. Like, that's the pun of the movie. Mm. Like, it's...
That's the premise.
Because he's like listening to all the rap music and watching BET on the 12 TV wall thing that he has. Like, yeah.
How ostentatious.
Yeah.
12 TVs on one wall.
Yeah, it was a weird scene.
That's like a, you know, that's what...
I don't remember a whole lot about it.
It's one of those things that I'm sure at the time was a sign of wealth. Now it just looks trashy to have that many monitors where it's like you're trying to link them all together. Now you just buy a 70-inch screen or something.
Right. I remember the scene. It was a bunch of TVs on the wall and they're all on different channels.
Yeah, only like supervillains do that.
Yeah.
Or it was weird. Or diehard gamblers that need to be watching like five different sports all at once. Like, I don't have their chariot racing over here and field hockey up here. You know,
and polo. What else do rich people watch?
The Russian roulette. Filmed from Russia. Like, yep. You know,
they watch the people form. Hunt other humans.
Yep, that happens as well.
Security cameras. They watch the servants.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Next movie.
Make sure they don't steal anything.
Next movie.
Sweet November. Do you guys know anything about this?
I don't.
It got 15% when it came out. It is a romantic drama, I guess, released maybe with the idea that Valentine's Day you would go see this movie.
Okay.
It stars Charlize Theron and Keanu Reeves. And it's very good. It's one of those really, this is such a cliched setup, but one of them has a terminal disease and is going to die.
Yeah.
In November, is that?
Yeah, that's basically supposed to be like, yeah, they had November together.
That's the ticking clock.
Right. So, again, that's what the reviews were saying, is like they had bad chemistry. It's very schmaltzy and a very manipulative story to just say, oh, this person's got cancer, they're gonna die. Like, it's such a you know, cheap way to extract tears from an audience, you know. So I don't think that was even worth like going into any further than that, but
nope.
Yeah, and then now we have the movie we actually did watch, unless you got any others.
Nope.
Hannibal came out, the I'm sure at the time long-awaited sequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, Silence of the Lambs, what, 95?
Yeah. And I believe it's one of only a handful of films, not that the Oscars have any divine sight as to what true filmmaking really is, but at least that year it ended up getting all of like the five major awards, best film, best director, best writing, best actor, best actress.
Yep.
All of them.
I think
were won by Silence of the Lambs.
The one previous to Silence of the Lambs that won those big five was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest back in 75. So it'd been quite some time before. Yeah. There was like that sort of sweep.
And yeah, you know, so we're getting this movie a bit further down the line, and you'll notice that Jonathan Demme, who is alive at the time, didn't direct it. Instead, this gets passed off to our boy, Ridley Scott. He directs this, which is pretty wild. And as I understand, it had to do with the juggling of studios. Like, the rights to the book were jostled around between different studios or something like that, that prevented him from having even the option of directing it. Also, you'll notice that, of course, the centerpiece, the movie is really centered around Hannibal Lecter, a serial killer, and then Clarice, who is like an FBI agent, right? And you'll notice that Jodie Foster is not returning.
Right.
She outright turned down the role. She did not want to be in it because she didn't like the portrayal of the character.
Yeah, we should have had Dez on for this podcast if she was feeling better. But she actually knows a lot about the series of books about Hannibal Lecter and this Clarice Darling character. Mm-hmm. And I guess like the books were being authored as they were making like more of these movies, but further along in the series, of course. But there's a point where the Clarice Starling character just like outright joins the Hannibal Lecter killing spree, and they like become involved romantically, and Jodie Foster rightly, did not like that. I don't like that very much either.
Yeah, that is a bit creepy on a number of different levels. Mm. But yeah, so Julianne Moore replaces her. She's a great actress. So I don't know what else to say. Just more technical stuff about it. Written by David Mamet. David Mamet is an amazing writer and an okay-ish director. You know, he's really best when he's got the pen in his hand. Very, very smart writer, I guess you could say. Like a lot of writers, when they're coming up with the script, the dialogue is there to bludgeon you with a plot. He loves to have dialogue that's not about nothing, but it's about the way people interpret words being used. Very difficult to describe, but it's just the way he likes to write. He gets people in these wonderfully, not long-winded, but just in-depth conversations about their intentions and what they're thinking with each other. So a David Mamet script is really unlike any other. And you get a little bit of this. You see it a lot, especially with the way that he writes Hannibal Lecter, where Hannibal Lecter is always having this second level conversation with people. It's sort of like he's having the immediate dialogue exchange, but he's also saying feels like every line out of his mouth is in some way intended to manipulate the person he's talking to.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance to the writing, especially the dialogue and the like the quick and dirty example I could give. Like if you have like a married couple arguing about how they're putting the cap back on the toothpaste, the argument is not actually about how the cap is put on the toothpaste. They have deeper issues going there.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it. I mean, I don't know, where should we begin? Like, do you want to talk about the plot a little bit? Like, what this whole thing is all about?
I don't know what the thing is.
Let's talk about, let's start with plot then, since Wes doesn't know what this movie is. So, Hannibal Lecter is a murderer who eats people.
Yeah, I know that part.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I don't know who Clarice is. I don't know. This has to do with Silence of the Lambs.
As I recall, because I didn't get a chance to watch the first one again, but in the first one, the FBI is trying to hunt down another serial killer.
Right.
And they want to use Hannibal Lecter to kind of get into the mind of the killer and kind of
using him to help create a profile. Jodie Foster's character, Clarice Starling, is the FBI trainee agent who goes in because they think that he will pity her or like try to manipulate her, take her under his wing. So they are using her to get to him.
Yeah.
Hannibal Lecter, that is. So that they can find this other killer who's already
this on the Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
Okay. And so, then throughout the course of the events, you know, oopsie doopsie, he gets out. And as the movie ends, he is now basically a free man.
Yeah, he's escaped. He's absconded.
Yes. Mm. So.
So this, Hannibal is the sequel, and now he's free and eating people.
Sort of.
He is free.
They immediately introduce a person worse than him.
Oh.
Who is going to be our major villain for this. I mean, Hannibal Lecter is still very much a villain of this story. But they introduce someone who is I don't think he's that captivating a person, but like he's just objectively evil and awful.
Mm.
This other rich person... why can't I think of the actor?
Is it Gary Oldman?
Gary Oldman. Yeah, again, another chameleon performance from Gary Oldman. But apparently, at some point, many decades prior to this, this guy had gone to Hannibal Lecter, basically made a pass at him or something, and then Hannibal Lecter drugged him, and then through a very gross scene, as the guy's like basically tripping out of his mind, tells him to shave his face off and then eat it. Feed it to the dogs.
Yeah, this movie is fucking gruesome.
And Roger Ebert's review, he said, if this movie doesn't get an NC-17 rating, nothing will.
Hmm.
It is very gross. There is a lot of really gruesome content here. But yeah, and basically, so this guy survives, right? His face is just totally jacked up. But now he wants to use his absorbent wealth to go after Hannibal Lecter.
Hmm. Yeah, now that Hannibal Lecter is out on the loose,
yes.
He is trying to gather any sort of resources or information he needs in order to get at him so he can exact his revenge.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the FBI is also on the hunt to find him, and they're keeping a close eye on Julianne Moore's character, Clarice, in an effort to make sure that they're not communicating. And all in the while, you have Dirtbag Ray Liotta within the FBI, who, with every single line of dialogue, reminds you that you won't be upset if he dies.
And he will.
Yes. So, and I think this is the big falling of the movie, and the reason why this movie But I don't think it's that bad. I just don't think it's great. I don't think this is a very good movie. I think it's fine. But I think the thing that... The problem with it is that what made the first one so good is when you get Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster talking to each other. And this movie deprives you of that for like 80% of the movie. They're nowhere near each other. Like, they exchange a couple of brief phone calls and there's a letter. But beyond that, they don't talk until the very end of the movie. So instead, you've basically got despicable Hannibal Lecter interacting with other people that are either just simply trying to shut him down or being despicable themselves, which isn't that great. Mm. You know?
Yeah, it's tough to figure out what it is that you're rooting for. You know, you have a person you can root for. You're rooting for Julianne Moore to, you know, track down all the nefarious people who are, you know, got their machinations employed here. But the stakes aren't like as high as they were in Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs, there is a killer on the loose. They are trying to find him. In Hannibal Lecter is the killer on the loose. And you wouldn't really feel too bad if, like, he gets caught and killed, because he is himself a killer. Like, he can be a fascinating character, but he's ultimately like this demon who's on the loose. Like, are you supposed to be rooting for him to evade, like, the revenge of this Gary Oldman character?
Yeah, it's not like you're watching, like, it's not like you're watching a Venom movie and it's like the anti-hero and you're rooting for him.
Right, there's no girl down in the well that you're trying to save.
It's like, Wes, I remember you talking about this movie recently where it was like King Kong versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
It's like, are you really rooting for either one of them? Like, as that movie happens, I don't know.
I mean, the movie kind of pushes you to root for King Kong. Because it's like focused on him.
Go Mammals.
And Godzilla just kind of pops up here and there just to show up, fuck things up, and leave. But by the end of the movie, it's just like, now we gotta fight the robot Godzilla. And they go their separate ways. Yeah.
So then it kind of asks you the question, like, who's worse? Is it the non-murderer pedophile, or is it Hannibal Lecter, who, again...
The cannibal.
The cannibal who kills and eats people.
You I mean...
it's like, both are bad.
It depends. If he kills people, then eats them, I probably would say cannibal. But if he's just eating people that are already dead, I would go with the pedophiles worse.
But he's... But he... Wes on the side...
That's tough. That's tough. I probably would still go pedophile. Like, that's just fucked up shit. I mean,
Wes on the side of pedophiles. Okay. This just took a weird turn.
I'm against the pedophiles. I'd say they're worse.
I think we could all say definitively on this podcast, we are anti-pedophiles.
We are anti-pedophiles, 100%.
Let's put the foot down.
We're taking a strong stand. We don't care about the backlash. Yeah. We are anti-pedophile, 100%.
On this podcast. Our local politicians do not represent us.
Never mind.
Back to base. Like, that's kind of what happens. Is you've got a detective in Italy that is also and he's a little self-interested in that he wants to get this big reward money. So instead of just calling up like, "Hey, Clarice, guess who I found?" He's very much trying to do this on the sly. So he can be the one that arrests Hannibal Lecter. And
He's trying to sell out Hannibal Lecter to Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
He's looking for him.
So he's trying to get a payday there. So he is also, even though you're kind of rooting for him, it's sort of like, make a real dumb decision here, dude. Like, this guy is... Hannibal Lecter is the smartest guy in the room, and he's also the most dangerous. Like, don't fuck with him. Don't fuck with him.
Yeah, you know, for a lot of the movie, a good portion of the movie, he's the guy who's in the sort of most immediate danger. But he's also, like, not an interesting enough guy for you to really, like, latch onto and be like, okay, I hope he makes it to the end. Yeah. You're just kind of, like, following his plot to see if the Gary Oldman character ends up getting closer to Hannibal Lecter.
But he really took a step up in terms of wives. Look at how pretty his wife was. Mm. Yep. You know?
Now, that's why he needs all that money, because she was about a bit materialistic.
Yeah,
that
that's wife. True.
I think they try to use that to build some sympathy around his character. But I don't know. I think it ultimately kind of falls flat. But like Hannibal Lecter, you can't root for him. He's the guy who says, cut off your face and feed it to the dogs. And he's the guy who cuts off Ray Liotta's head and says, Ray Liotta, I cooked some of your own brain for you.
This
movie is fucking gruesome.
That is the big highlight moment in terms of how gross a movie can be. Where Ray Liotta's at the dinner table and he's got a hat on and he chains...
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Fuck.
He thinks he's just joining them for dinner. I mean, he's very heavily sedated, so he can't feel pain and he can barely communicate. But he's there, you know, with Clarice. And then he takes the hat off, and his entire skull is gone. Like, his entire skull is gone, and it's just sort of his exposed brain on top. And then Hannibal Lecter starts cutting it off and cooking it and feeding it to him.
It's really gross.
It's very, very gross. Again, if that doesn't get you an NC-17 rating, what will? Like, how did that one get by the censors? We're like, well, at least there wasn't a titty.
Nobody said fuck, so right. We're okay here.
Yeah, and
which back in that day, fuck still wasn't even showing up that much in R-rated.
Yeah.
Nowadays, if there's just one fuck in it, it's still PG-13.
Yeah. You can
you can't use it as a
fuck. Fuck the moon onto your
rocket. Yeah, but it's still PG-13. I forgot about that.
So yeah, ultimately, I don't know. I feel like this lacked the charm of the first one. I think Anthony Hopkins is still great at being this character. He just feels a little less charismatic.
Yeah, the cat and mouse game isn't between your two starring characters anymore. The cat and mouse game is now like has all these layers in between, either your two leads or Gary Oldman. And Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. But yeah, shall we get down to the budget and box office?
Let's do it.
Oh boy.
What do you think oh, you didn't see the film.
I cannot.
What do you think the budget was?
100 million.
What'd you say?
100 million. I have no idea at all. There's no way it's that much.
50 million?
Believe it or not, Wes would be closer. It was 87 million.
Oh, what shit. The hell?
I mean, you probably got to pay a lot to get Anthony Hopkins there to do that.
It seemed like they were on location a lot too.
Yeah.
I'm shooting a lot in Italy.
It's a good-looking film. And hey, credit to Ridley Scott. He made it, as grotesque as this thing is, he made a good-looking thing. How much do you think it made?
150.
210.
351
million. Ooh, good for that.
People were probably really clamoring for this. I mean, I can imagine. Again, this was like, imagine if there was like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest 2. Like, what people would be like, holy shit, we gotta go see this thing, you know? It's like, oh, Empire Strikes Back? Yeah, let's fucking do it. So I think, considering just how captivated the audiences were by Hannibal Lecter as a character, people were probably really excited to see this movie, and probably a little bit let down.
Biggest movie of the month?
I'm by assuming? Far, by far. Mm. Yeah, $351 million is a lot.
Talk about we head down to Earth. We
And it's only a couple hundred million off of the two highest grossing movies. Like, the number one movie was, like, way the number one movie. The number two movie, and I won't spoil, but the number two movie was like, $650, as I recall.
For all of 2001, you mean?
Yeah, for all of 2001. So
have we gotten the first one yet?
No, we haven't gotten either of those yet.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just saying, just from a point of perspective, Hannibal will be one of the best highest grossing movies of the year.
Wes, what's your guess? What's the highest grossing movie of 2001?
I don't even know what came out in 2001. I couldn't make that guess.
I'm not entirely sure what came out either, but I'm going to guess.
I mean, if you gave me a list, I could be like that. I mean,
yeah, but that's still fun.
Want a clue?
Was it Phantom Menace?
Phantom Menace, I think it was 99.
Hmm.
Or maybe 2000. No, it couldn't have been 2000. It was 99. Okay. I'll give you a clue. That would be an answer to this statement, but both movies are the first installment of long-running series.
Oh, is it Lord of the Rings?
No.
Ah, damn.
First installment of long-running series? Fuck.
Passion of the Christ?
No.
No, I should talk.
Do you want to be spoiled? Do you really want to be spoiled?
I should stop taking guesses. I should let Wes take a guess here. But
I can't think of what could have come out around 2001. I mean, I was a lot younger than you guys, so.
You're like 4 years younger
I'm than a lot younger than you guys, like tons.
So yeah, you're Gen Z over there.
It's a pretty big gap between you and me, John, all right? You're dead like tomorrow. I mean,
I'll give you a clue. You work with it, and you probably read the whole book series.
Oh.
Oh, it was a Harry Potter.
Yep.
Oh. Yeah.
And okay. The first Harry Potter movie will come out at some point this year. I don't know what
that is. The most? Oh, yeah, it is Harry Potter. I mean, at that point, how many books are out?
It's pretty highly anticipated.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, let's not go into it any further.
Yeah.
All right. Any more in closing shots to this movie?
Ooh, it is gross. Like, this is like, I don't know how we have the stomach to like watch it. Like, this is like cringy. Gruesome. Like, and then the
only part that really got me was the face cutting off stuff. I think the eating the brain thing is just
goes through the Rubicon of absurdity where I'm just like, oh, you. I mean, there's the feeding the people to the boars thing, mm-hmm. but that's no worse than your run-of-the-mill zombie scene where all the zombies are on the guy and they're eating his guts like it's a buffet.
And it's the second movie in as many months where there's some villain feeding people to pigs, because they did that in Snatch, too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Longer than they knew. They knew back in 2001 that the boars are going to be a problem and we'd have to deal with it.
Yeah. Oh, and that is actually a point I wanted to make, not about boars. But just that, again, remember how good December was in the box office? Like, it's still February.
It's packed.
There's still tons of stuff for your average moviegoer to work through. So I'm sure that the theater was bumping.
Yeah, down to earth.
You know? Yeah.
Wedding Plan is probably still showing.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Music?
Yeah, music. Can we take a time out?
Yeah, let's take a quick break and come back to some music.
Cool. You got into, or do you want to just go through the list?
Let's go through the list.
Get to them when we get to them?
Yeah.
All right, so let's do it then. This was a very busy month for music. A lot going on, lots of different stuff, especially if you like indie pop rock or punk music. You had yourself a month. I'll start with two albums off the top that both went platinum. Jack Johnson, Brushfire Fairytales. Do you know who that guy is?
No, I don't.
He is a acoustic guitar kind of folkish musician. He was a surfer. From Hawaii, who started making music.
Okay.
He makes sort of that definitive, like, coffee shop music, like stuff you would expect to hear in, like, a very chill, relaxed environment. So, very quiet, breathy singing, and very pretty acoustic guitar. Very soulful, but not, you know, because when you think of island music, you probably start thinking about reggae. It ain't reggae, you know.
Like, someone has played on a ukulele or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is just really good. Very mellow and enjoyable. Of course, this album is going to go platinum. I forget what the big single was on it, but it did him well. And yeah, he's going to release a number of really successful albums over the next 10 years or so. So keep an eye out for that. And if you just want a chill, relax album, Brushfire Fairytale, it'll give you two. Dave Matthews Band released an album called Every Day.
Yeah.
And this one was pretty big. I mean, their other albums had sold a little bit more, but this still sold like 3 million copies. Had I Did It, Space Between, and Every Day were all pretty big singles when they came out.
Yeah, those are the ones that are released on the radio.
Yeah. Only thing really that I noticed interesting about, like, for one, I would say this is actually a really good record. You know, Dave Matthews Band is like a jam band, but this is very much a pop-oriented album.
Yeah.
Like, the songs are all under 5 minutes. Normally jam bands, you think of their songs as going for 6 to 12 minutes of improvisation, and yeah, that happens here.
In previous Dave Matthews albums, that would be a short song.
The song normally doesn't go 12 hours, but I forgot how it ended, and we kind of got into a thing.
Yep. And it's good. Honestly, this is a really good record. It's Dave Matthews Band knows their way around hooks. They've got a really good sense of melody, and they know how to get earworm hooks. So
yeah, I really dug this album. Back in the day, I first heard this because I'd been aware. I'd owned some Dave Matthews albums before this one came out, and I first became aware that this came out when I was taking the driver's class that you got to take in the state of Florida before you're able to get your license. You got to go
like
to
driver's
like,
ed or something,
like, or traffic school. Driving school. Not like the actual, like, where you go with a person.
Go to the course and all that.
Yeah. But you, like, have to sit down and, like, learn, like, what road signs mean and shit like that.
Nice.
So, but it was, like, in Seminole County, it was, like, a 3, maybe a 4-hour course. You had to take a test at the end, but there was, like, a couple of breaks that they put in there. And the place I was taking this course well, when I was 15, 16 years old, right around the corner was a Circuit City. May it rest in peace.
Oh, wow. Oh God.
And I'm really aging myself here. And of course, I had like a demo kiosk. And I would like for music with a pair of headphones. And when we took the first break, I just went over there and just started looking at things. Was looking through the demo kiosk. Like, oh, Dave Matthews has a new song. And I played it and listened to it. And then every break after that, I would go back and listen to the same album again. Like, yep, listen to this again. Yep, give it to me again. And ended up buying the CD not too long after that. But yeah, I really dug this album. Played it a ton of times. And I actually went looking for it when I saw this this thing was... The album was released in February of 2001. Couldn't find it. I lost it somewhere.
Even on Spotify? Oh, your actual physical...
No, I actually went... I was going to play it in my car.
Wow!
Yeah, yeah. I went looking for my CD.
Take that, Team America World Police soundtrack.
I know, right? God, I never should have made the switch. I should have kept the Dave Matthews one in. This was, like you were saying, like much more of a poppy album. Much more of like an electric guitar sound rather than like a lot of the acoustic stuff. A lot of the jams, like with the saxophone and the violin, are shorter. Like you were saying, the songs are shorter in general. And there's like interesting, I guess, is like maybe a bit of a stretch, but there's a history behind like why the song sounds the way it does. So their longtime producer that worked with them with their other studio albums, I think it's Steve Lillywhite, as I think the guy's name. They were working on an album right after their third studio, Before These Crowded Streets, came out. They started working on another studio album with Steve Lillywhite, and like Before These Crowded Streets is like this really experimental jam band music where like a lot of the songs is almost like a chanting quality to some of the melodies, but they started working on a new studio album and they weren't really getting to the place they wanted to be with it. So they put it on pause and then they went out to work on a different studio album with a producer, Glenn Ballard. And that's what turned into Every Day, which is a very different sound what they were working on with Steve Lillywhite. The stuff that they were, a lot of the songs they were working on with Steve Lillywhite before they released Every Day ended up getting released in an album in 2002 called Busted Stuff. But before that album comes out, a lot of the songs they were working on with Steve Lillywhite ended up leaking. Someone who worked in the recording studio, working for the producer, ended up leaking this onto the internet. A lot of people downloaded it and it became like colloquially known as the Lillywhite Sessions. The band was not happy that this stuff got out. They were pissed. And you can even find, and I did recently, you can find like this 5-minute interview they do with Carson Daly about Every Day and about the Lillywhite Sessions leaking out and how they were feeling about it at the time. And it seemed like in this interview they were in a little bit of damage control. I don't know like what sort of things they were saying about the album leaking before this, like if they were like had a lot of vitriol toward people who were downloading it, but it seemed like they were trying to do a little bit of cleanup. Like, well, we're not mad at people for downloading it. We're happy that, you know, people want to hear our stuff. So they're going out of their way to hear stuff they've never heard before. That's really cool. But they were not happy that someone leaked it out there because like, well, it's like if we were making a painting and it wasn't finished yet. And then people started looking. It's like, wait, that's not done. Don't look at it. I don't want you to see it yet. Yeah. Which I think is a reasonable position to take. Like, if you're not finished with something, you don't think it's ready for people to hear, you're probably going to be a little mad that people are listening to it already.
Totally. Well, you know what's interesting? We'll talk about it later, but there's another band that literally found themselves in the same scenario on the list for this month.
Yeah.
But yeah, it reminds me of a different time too back then where literally like people would always be hunting for like, oh, something leaked or this album's out now. And it's like because everyone was just downloading records. So as soon as it became available, people were just going to snatch it up as quick as they could. Now, like, I don't give a shit. There's so much music all the time for me that when it comes out, I listen to it. When it's available for streaming, I'm like, let me check it out. I'm not out there hunting on peer-to-peer websites to get something a week ahead of time when I'm supposed to get it.
Here's this bootleg track from a live recording,
right?
Or a live concert.
Actually, I remember when I worked at a music store, we did that one day where everyone said, okay, write down your favorite record labels. And everyone just wrote down all their favorite record labels. And we emailed their PR teams. And we're just like, hey, we work at a record store. If you send us promo packages, we'll play the music in stores. And I'm not kidding, probably about 10 different record labels bit.
Okay.
And all just sent us stuff. It was amazing. So we were always getting the stuff before it came out. And again, we tried to do our best to literally play it. And that's why they did it. It was a you know, beneficial relationship. Mm-hmm. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. We get your music ahead of time that we really like your label. We'll play it in the store and try to generate some sales. So yeah, different times.
But that's all to say. They did something totally different with Every Day, and I really like what they ended up doing.
Yeah, I think it resulted in some really good songs. And yeah, Space Between was really a strong ballad for them. Mm-hmm. I remember that being a really big track back in the day. So
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so we'll move on to the pop rock category. The number one band listed, not in sales, mind you, but in terms of reviews on that album of the year website, was this group called Low. They released an album called The Things We Lost in the Fire. I don't know how this ended up being the number one record of the month. Critics at the time wrote very adoring reviews of it, and fans seemed to like it, but this is about as boring as you can get. Oh my God, this record is just... like it's a not a couple, but it's a duo. It's a male and a female, and it's just this very somber, sad music. Like, think of in your mind like a Protestant church full of people that don't want to be singing the song. That's what this album sounds like to me. It's so slow. All the tracks are downer tracks. There's really not even enough developed melodies in it to like catch on to anything. People really like it, though. Like, maybe it's for you and not for me, but, like, I didn't find anything really rewarding or enjoyable in listening to this, and I gave it at least a good 3 or 4 spins, start to finish, just hoping that it would click. It didn't. Next, another big indie rock band, Spoon. They released an album called Girls Can Tell. Spoon is from Austin, Texas. I really didn't listen to this band much, but I know that from, like, early 2000s to mid-2000s, they're going to release a slew of hit records. For the indie set, not like huge commercial or hit records, but for people that like indie rock, they're going to latch on to these guys. And I can see why people like this band. They're very good. They're very fun, very cheeky. It's almost like a lounge band in a way. They've just got a really cool, casual style to the way they play. I like the singer's voice. He's very aloof with the lyrics he writes and the way that he sings. It's just very fun. And there's always a nice, prominent bass line throughout. So get that one. That one is worth a listen. Life Without Buildings. I had never heard of this band. A Life Without Buildings released an album called Any Other Cities. This is their one and only record that they will make as a band. They are from Scotland, and they are making a sound called post-punk, which is, if you get into any sounds, it's this sort of angular guitar music that's a little off-kilter, but still very punk-like in a way. It's sort of like if you just try to mix in a lot more pop into what you know as traditional punk. Any rate, they make this one album, and I like it. I don't know if I like it. I think that it's really well produced, and the band is nice, but their singer, oh my God. It's this woman named Sue Thompson, and she just, like, the way, she has this very, like, cat-like voice, this very, like, youthful, animated, pixie-like voice, and she's not even, like, delivering traditional rhymes. It's sort of like she's got 5 phrases stuck in her head that she just delivers, like, she's doing, like, a scat performance, like, just sort of singing you these little snippets of words over and over and over again, over these songs. So you've got this really tightly wound band playing very structured music, and her just going off on top of the record. And it rarely works. There are a couple of songs where I'm like, that's genuinely good. But for the most part, it just, her voice gets so grating after a while. It really just drains you if you're trying to enjoy this record. I'm sure this sounds weird as I describe it, but, like, you got to give it a listen to really take it in. Again, people love this. And, oh, by the way, these were all art students. This was not a group of kids trying to, like, make it big in music. That's the reason why the band broke up, is because they all wanted to get to their individual visual arts stuff that they were doing. They just did this as sort of a fun aside and ended up stumbling into a really big...
10 years later, they can say, record. Like, hey, remember when we made that album?
Yeah. So there's a record. There's a record reviewing group called NME, based out of Britain, and they're notoriously like, who were the is it Statler and Waldorf, the two old guys, and the thing that just trash everyone.
Oh god,
that's kind of what NME is. Like, they love just trashing British music. Like, they're so great. But this is literally how their review for the album opened. I love this quote. It says, "For some, the scrape of nails on fingernails on a blackboard is an exquisite sensation. Dentist drills provide a satisfying tingle. Animals dying in agony make a heavenly choir. And Sue Tompkins, idiosyncratic front woman of Life Without Buildings, makes a beautiful noise." Just bury her. Oh my
god. They could have gone with one metaphor. No. They needed all three.
She has a family, guys. Like, that's not...
And she's literate and has a feelings.
There are people that will listen to it and tell you she's the best thing about the music. There are people that will listen to it and say that about it. Also, keep in mind, she's Scottish, so, like, to us, there's kind of a novelty to someone being Scottish and sounding Scottish.
Mm.
I'm sure to him, he listens to Scottish people all the time being in England, so it's nothing new to him. It would just be, like, one of us assholes just saying a bunch of random shit over some talented musicians.
there's probably, like, I have to imagine that there are people in England who kind of, like, have stereotypical views about other people's accents, kind of like how... You know, we think all people from Minnesota sound like this, and it kind of becomes a punchline.
Minnesota.
So, exactly. Don't kinda, you know?
Don't you know? Oi. Or A. They go A, right?
Yeah.
It's like Canadians.
Probably both.
Probably both.
A lot of people can say letter A.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't they share a border with Canada? It's practically the same place.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
We should add the wall around that, too.
No, we like Minnesota.
You also have a band called Tortoise. They released a record. This is an instrumental post-rock group, but not post-rock like some of the other ones we've been talking about.
It's a little slow-paced.
It's actually kind
of... What are you talking about?
The name of the band is Tortoise.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, now we're on the same page.
That's a good point. Yeah, you do bring up an interesting point.
But I'm...
If you listen, I would say, for one, yes, you should listen to Tortoise. They're a very good band. They make instrumental music that's usually a little more cinematic than this record is. This one's actually a lot leaner. It's focused more around drum and bass, like, you know, actual drum kit and, you know, bass guitar. I think
upright, though.
Opposed to the metaphorical ones.
Yeah.
Like not a drum machine is what I mean to say. Or okay. Like a, you know.
Or like a cello, like a plebeian.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to see a rock band just rock a cello instead of a bass.
There is actually a band called Murder by Death that has a cello in there. They're really, really good. They sound like a kind of like a Dust Bowl, deathy Midwest kind of rock music. They're good. But yeah, they have a cellist in their band as opposed to a traditional upright bass or an actual electric bass.
Hmm.
I'm just talking though. No. Oh no, it's a... Yeah, Tortoise. They're solid. This is a good record. I think this is probably their most accessible record they've ever made. It's called Standards. It's pretty good. A group called Arab Strap released an album called The Red Thread. Do you guys know what an Arab Strap is?
Mm.
It is a cock ring. Apparently. Okay. That is a nice term for a cock ring. I had to look that up. I didn't know until I found out, like, just from reviewing what this band is.
So now in your Google search bar, there's... essentially another name for cock ring.
No, Wikipedia will let you click the button that says disambiguous Arab strap, and then it goes straight to cock ring, and I was like, oh, okay.
When I have to search for something that I think might be a euphemism or maybe something racist, I always like turn on incognito mode. That way Google doesn't like remember in my... like, and recommend something similar to that.
Well, based on your search for cock rings.
Like you're right. Saying, your Amazon search.
Here's some butt plugs. I don't like
it. Right, like, I don't need, like, I know where to get my butt plugs. I don't need Amazon telling me where to go. But, like, or even if it's something, like, if I see one of the younger kids who I work with say a phrase, I don't know what that means. Let me look this up. Incognito mode. I don't need anyone knowing ever.
They were telling you about their drips.
Sure.
See, now I gotta turn on incognito mode real quick.
Always use incognito mode. And like if
drip is the new term I've heard going around for outfits.
Okay.
Like your clothes you're wearing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Like threads.
Yeah.
Sure. Was,
old man.
People say these things.
I'm telling you, he's dead tomorrow.
Our digs. Hang on, do we have more? I think that's it. I think that's the only two I got.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. So the album's called The Red Thread. This is also a Scottish band.
Not their clothes.
So what would I say? Like, this is a pretty good record. I think when I first listened to it, my first takeaway was like, this is boring. But I went back to it and gave it a second listen, and I was like, okay, there's actually some interesting stuff happening here. I think it's just that this album is so, like, so set aback from the listener. It takes time to develop things. I mean, it is essentially your traditional, you know, guitar, drums, bass, keyboards, that kind of stuff. It's just kind of the way that it all plays out is you just kind of got to groove with it. It's weird to say that it's best when you don't listen. Like, you have it on, but you're not actively focusing on it. And then when it kind of starts to seep in to your brain, it just feels so good. Like, it's really a good record. This, again, first listen, I was like, I didn't notice anything interesting. Second listen, I was like, this is pretty good. Third and fourth, like, this is when I bring up my list of albums from February 2001, it's kind of become the one that I go to and play.
You just had to get used to the cock ring.
Just got to, you know.
Just got to give it time.
You get adjusted. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like the way that they record the drums. It doesn't feel too immediate. And they use actually a lot of like trip hop drum beats, which is not really what you would expect from a Scottish indie rock band, I guess. But yeah. And one quick hit, a guy named Stephen Malcolmus released his self-titled album. He was in a band called Pavement back in the day. Pavement is a really important band in the world of like indie college rock in like the very late 80s and early 90s. They were always an alternative to the grunge set. If you wanted something that was like fun indie rock but not so depressive, you always had a group like Pavement. Or maybe like REM. People probably know REM. So
sounds familiar.
So it was a fun enough listen. Like, I can see he's got his pop hooks. He's just very like silly. Like, his lyrics are silly. But all in all, it was pretty good. Two hip-hop records. Jay Dilla released Welcome to Detroit. We've talked about Jay Dilla a number of times indirectly because he's come up on, I think, like half a dozen records we talked about from 2000 associated with hip-hop. He is a producer. This is one where it's really just him showcasing his beats. He raps over them. I don't think he's a particularly good rapper. I hate to say it. After a first few listens, I switched to the instrumental version of this record. It's great. It's so pretty. It's really, really nice. You see him working through his like turntablist stuff. Music Concrete, even. He starts doing these soundscapes where he sort of sets the vibe of an album called Welcome to Detroit. You feel like you hear the grime of the streets that he's recording from.
The sirens.
Yeah. It's just
the buildings collapsing.
Yeah, the fires. Just the indiscriminate fires. Yeah. Dice games where people get shot. You know, classic Detroit.
just a real welcoming place.
Yeah, and just people just being like, oh, the Lions did it again. Fuck them.
You just hear the sound of the car plants closing.
Yep, that's precisely it. All right, one other record, Project Pat, released Mr. Don't Play. Project Pat is a member of 3-6 Mafia, who is from Memphis. This is like just dirty, hardcore hip-hop. I love this record, though. It's great. It's really, really good. I think it's just that I really like this sound. I think the Southern hip-hop sound of the early 2000s is really good. It's very influential on today's hip-hop. Just a lot of raw drum machines, heavy bass lines, and just dirty rapping. Dirty rapping about being a drug dealer. You know, this guy's... he's doing it. This album is, believe it or not, I've been trashing a lot of these records that do this. This one's 73 minutes long. It somehow doesn't feel like it's 73 minutes. This is just... it's a fun one. It's got a lot of really good songs on it. Totally recommend it. Now we move into the world of punk. We're like about halfway through the list.
Here we go.
Oh, okay. So we've got...
wait, man, but...
yeah. We've got Lightning Bolt. They are from Rhode Island. It's a duo of just bass and drums. They released an album called Ride the Skies, but this is a noise band. So not like Wolf Eyes, which you talked about, which use a lot of electronic equipment to make noise. You would just be amazed at the cacophony of noise these two guys can make just with one bass guitar and a drum. It is just this wall of sound, loud stuff. The drumming is manic. It sounds like drum fills from like freeform jazz constantly. And then the bass is just going. And you're kind of constantly like in awe of the various sounds that this guy can make using a bass guitar. It's a hard listen, though. Very hard listen if you don't listen to a lot of noise music. So I'll be like, you know, whatever. You got American Hi-Fi They released a self-titled album. This is a Boston-based group, or at least the main guy behind it. His name's Stacey Jones. He's from Boston. He is famous for having been the drummer for some other pop groups like Letters for Cleo, or Letters to Cleo and Veruca Salt. It's pretty good. They had that song Flavor of the Week. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yeah.
I remember when I first sat down to listen to this, I didn't know this guy's pedigree. I just assumed it was a bunch of, like, 20-year-old, like, suburban kids made this record. It's actually a really well-produced, really nice slab of what you would call power pop. I think it's good. And yeah, that Flavor of the Week track, it's very much targeted at, like, teenage boys, but the rest of the material on there is not so focused on that.
That's interesting, because that was, like, the single. That was the one that got played on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A huge, huge success for this group. So, yeah. Next, we've got Propagandhi released today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes. We'll get to the end of the year. I will tell you this is one of my top 10 albums of the year.
Really?
I really, really love this.
Propagandhi?
Yeah, Propagandhi. It is a three-piece from Canada. They play kind of this old-school sound of Fat and Epitaph-style skate punk. I think the thing that I love about them is that they are so tightly wound. Their music is so fucking tight. Their riffs are on point. The melodies are fantastic. The singers, both their singers, sound incredible. The drums are constantly propulsive and moving forward. They're almost like a thrash metal band. It's strange. You would think this was a metal group if not for the fact that they were constantly incorporating just the mechanics and sound of skate punk. And I think probably the thing that makes them resonate the most is their lyrical content, because, like, it's so low effort to hear punk bands being like, you know, fuck the police, all cops are bastards, you know, like, all that.
I hate my parents.
Yeah, you know.
Middle finger to all authority.
Yeah, fuck the government.
Do homework.
I'd never wear a suit and tie, you know, that kind of shit. You know, and it's nice to see a band that has studied and deeply care about the beliefs that they put on this record.
Establishment.
Who was that band that did that song? The lyrics were pretty much just sex and violence over and over again.
Oh, Bush. Yeah. Or, like, yeah. I mean, like, the Dead Kennedys have a song called Lynch the Landlord. Like, that's pitch perfect. Like, that's Dead Kennedys. But here's the thing. Like, the Propagandhi twice references the Dead Kennedys on this album. No, but, like, they talk about government, like, governments instilling puppet governments in smaller nations. They talk about what it means to be a true feminist. They talk about addressing race, their fellow, like, the white people in Canada who are just overtly racist, just going at them, like, every track, animal rights abuses, like, every track captures maturely, like, one of these topics and doesn't make it, that doesn't feel like it needs a studded leather jacket and a mohawk to make a point. It's just very smart.
Hockey jerseys with a pompadour.
I mean, the mohawk is a very good way to get your point across. If you see a mohawk, you're like, that guy's got something to say. Yeah, he's...
But yeah, I mean, if today's Empire is Tomorrow Ashes. Oh, and then this is kind of a sea change album for the band too, because they're going to release some albums later on. They're going to have one called Potemkin City Limits, and then one after that called Supporting Cast. And oh my God, these are just amazing. You will not hear a band fuse so well mechanically punk music with just the sound, energy, and venom of metal. This album just rips. I do love it.
I listened to this one. It was one of the few that I listened to.
Oh, well, what do you think? Did any of that ring true?
Totally. I think on point. Well, I only listened to one way through, so I haven't given it the repeat listenings. But yeah, I think you're totally on point with all of that. The driving power cars, like, you're playing very fast. I didn't know that there were two singers, but now, like, thinking back on it, there are definitely, like, a couple of different. Definitely a couple of different sounds going on.
It's probably like 90% one guy and 10% another guy.
Oh shit, there was literally a reissue in 2021 for this.
I bought two copies of it, yes. I'm not kidding.
Wait, why did you buy two?
Because the limit was two. I would have bought five if I could.
Would you do with five?
It's going to go out of... I mean, it's already immediately gone out of print. They're worth
far more than... Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're talking about vinyl you buy and you're collecting them. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm the type that's flipping them, but again, I love this record so hard. I already had a copy of it on vinyl too, so I just bought two more because it's, again, it's a remastered. There, so they re-recorded it, or at least they redid it in studio.
This is a reissue, so I mean, yeah. Is it better than the original one? Or
I didn't notice much of a difference from listening to it personally, but you know.
But like
I didn't take each record and put them side by side with the headphones and really soak it in. But yeah,
anyway, well, like you were saying with the lyrics and the subject that they're tackling, it's something that you don't hear, especially like pop music at the start of the millennium, like these sorts of like subversive or like counterculture lyrics or more progressive. Ways of looking at things. You don't really start to see that until after September.
Yes. This is a band that's ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff, I think. They're far more progressive than anyone was at the time. They're far more aware of military intervention being a bad thing.
Mm.
And it would be nice.
That's a bad thing?
Yeah.
Well, depends. Are you an arms dealer or a mercenary?
Yes.
Then it's a great thing for you.
That's a good point.
It's a great time to be OS.
Yes. Oh. Okay, let's move on, though, because, again...
What do you do in your free time?
I have to raise children.
Oh, man. So it does get in the way of mercenary.
Who will one day overthrow governments, though?
Well, we can only hope.
Yes.
We can only hope.
All right, moving on. There's so many good punk records this month. Next one, another one that I absolutely love, Dropkick Murphys, Single Out, Single Crowd.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a goodie.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I listened to it, but it's a goodie. Mm-hmm. John got me into Dropkick Murphys because he wouldn't shut up about them.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
When I lived with you.
Where does this one stand in your mind? With like, what is it? Is it Gangs All Here? I think there was two records that came out before.
Yeah,
this one.
I think you're right. I think it's their third studio album. And I think this is where they bring on like their bagpipe player and they start to evolve into the sound that they're mostly known for now. Because before that, they're sound was much more akin to like a hardcore punk, but you start to get to a lot of like the Celtic influence now that you're getting into Sing Loud, Sing Proud, and I think like this really holds up. I think it's a really good example of what their sound has become like this, and we'll get to the ones after this, but like Warrior's Code and Meanest of Times, like they have a really great run throughout the first decade of the 21st century, and like tons of really great tracks, like the title track, and now I'm forgetting.
I love Gauntlet. Single. Gauntlet's a really good song. Mm-hmm. What is it? Spicy McHaggis.
The closing track, Spicy McHaggis. Really, yeah, he was. They named the song after the new guy that they brought in to play bagpipes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking up the track listing now.
Oh yeah, and
it's weird. Yeah, like the singles, like Spicy McHaggis was one of the. Singles they released, but then also like the Gauntlet was one of the singles. The Wild Rover, they had a couple of like covers of like traditional like Irish folk songs, like the Wild Rover and Rocky Road to Dublin. Good Rats was one of the
Legend of Finn MacAmel. That was a, that was a traditional song.
Oh yeah, I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that
Good Rats. I love the song Good Rats.
But
like not a single track here is as long as all these tracks are 3 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm.
Like this album just punches so good.
Yeah, I don't think there's a weak track in the bunch here.
Yeah, and I think it's got a really good production. There's a lot to organize here in terms of a band, especially when they're bringing in all of these new influences, all these new instruments and this new sound. It's all organized so well. The production is so modern sounding. Like I listened to it today. It sounds crisp as hell. Like I think that they did such a good job. Yeah, and it's just a party. This is like a crowd pleaser of a record. These guys just, you hear them having fun as they're playing. This is very much, you know, a love letter to Boston. And just, yeah, great, great, great record. This band doesn't really have missteps. I don't think they've ever released a bad record. But this is a highlight for me. I think other albums have better songs. This might be cover to cover, like, the most consistent record, in my opinion.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, any more thoughts? Or should I move on?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Yeah. Okay, next, The Slackers. The Slackers released an album called Wasted Days. They are a ska band, but kind of unlike your other ska bands. Like, you think ska, you probably think like Less Than Jake or something like that, or the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. The Slackers are very much your traditional 60s Jamaican ska band. They're like a 10-piece. You know, they've got tons of brass and organ, all that stuff in the mix. They play this very laid-back style of jazz that, again, it doesn't sound like the two-tone stuff. It doesn't sound like third-wave ska. It's just very much trying to sound like the original 60s Jamaican ska. But this album specifically has a very New Orleans-influenced sound. It's the production's a lot muddier, and I think it's supposed to emulate that. It sounds like it's being recorded at some dance hall in Louisiana where there's no AC and it's 100 degrees. You know, it just feels like that. I dig it. I don't think it's one of their better records. It's just got that nice aesthetic over it. I remember liking ska a lot more back in the day. And I remember liking this band a lot back in the day. Still a fun listen. It's just, honestly, the whole ska scene is just a bit obnoxious.
Yeah.
It's just a bit grating. They're somehow managed to be worse than Juggalos, honestly. Like, it's because the Juggalos know where they're at. They know their station in life. I think it's that the ska kids think that they're better than everyone without understanding how far below everyone they are. It's a mess of a scene. It's a truly terrible mess of a scene, but I still love ska music. Frodus, you know, earlier you were talking about Dave Matthews having his album leak. This literally happened to the band, a band called Frodus, with an album called And We Washed Our Weapons in the Sea. They are a DC hardcore band. They sound like a lot of bands from the DC hardcore scene. Or more like punk hardcore, more punk oriented. But like a band like Drive Like Jehu, they sound a bit like a band called Fugazi. I guess you guys are giving me a look like I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, so sorry.
Are these words? I don't...
But if you're familiar with these scenes, you probably know the sound that this band would evoke. And yeah, like, they were going to release it on this one studio, but then the album leaked, and then the manager of that studio got into a legal battle over it and tried to sue some peer-to-peer platform to prevent, like, that had initially posted it.
I'm sure that went
and
well.
And pissed away all of the money that the band had. So they had to wait, and then eventually this album got released down the line.
Huh.
So it really does suck for them, but this is their last album they're going to make as a group. But they'll splinter off and make other bands, so it'll all work out in the end for the people involved. It's a good album. It's very, I don't know. Again, it's got that DC hardcore sound. Just give it a listen if you like that. And the last punk album I have to talk about is the Ataris. They released "End Is Forever." Mm-hmm. Do you know this one?
I do.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good record. On another listen, probably my favorite song by the band, "Teenage Riot," is on here. I really dig that tune. You know, I really don't have much to say about it because I feel like the guitar is kind of a known commodity.
Yeah, you know, I think what I know them most for is I think their next album coming up after this, which is So Long Astoria,
and
I think
that's a huge record. Yeah,
it's much more mature, but you can see like sort of the proto form of what they're going to become with that album with this one. It's a bit sophomoric. I think like they think they're writing something that's deeper than it is. Like they're talking about feelings and stuff and they matter. Well, you know, you're also, you know, there's not much subtlety happening with these lyrics. The lyrics are
so you're,
very,
you're a white teenager from Indiana and you like a girl.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. First one, huh?
But new territory. The lyrics are very emo. Yes. Even though the sound isn't really what you typically associate with something like a Dashboard Confessional or Taking Back Sunday. That's sort of like emo group. There's more energy to it. It's much more kinetic sound. But there's also like this sort of earnestness to their sound in the lyrics. Like they're writing that something that's like a slice of Americana. Yeah. And maybe that has to do with like the fact that they're from just nowhere Indiana.
Yeah.
Because there's like a sort of a doe-eyed sort of a quality to what it is that they're singing about. They're gonna get their heart broken by this girl, but gosh darn it, they love America. That's sort of like that sort of like quality comes out.
It's so sweet.
They're like 22, but nostalgic. You know, I actually don't know how old they are when they wrote this, but they sound like, you know, they're 22-year-olds going through something, but they really miss the good old days.
Yeah.
And, oh, guys, I got some bad news. Right. But yeah, but So Long Astoria is the one coming after this, and I think it's the one to watch for,
mm-hmm.
right, with this band.
Yeah. All right, let's move into electronic and ambient. We're kind of winding down here. You have Jan.
What do you mean, kind of? You hedged that a little bit.
Yeah. We got 20 more albums to go.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Let's do it.
I'm kidding. No. I got work in the morning, guys.
No, you like, don't.
I got it, things to do.
You're going to call in.
How far in are we?
Hour and a half.
Oh, boy. All right, we'll get through this. I'm sorry, guys.
It's okay.
This is always the longest
We segment. Had to talk about Dave Matthews.
A German composer named Jan Jelinek released an album called...
Say that 10 times fast.
Jan Jelinek. Yeah, that's a mouthful. released an album called Loop Finding Jazz Records. And just based on that title alone, you'd probably think it would sound more like Jay Dilla's album, Welcome to Detroit, where it's just all of these sample-based jazz records or whatever. It's not. There's actually very minimal techno, very minimal ambient techno.
I hear Welcome to Detroit. If anyone ever said that to me, I would be upset.
What if I said Clive Barker's Welcome to Detroit?
Oh!
Welcome to Detroit is like, you know...
I don't think there's going to be much difference.
It's like you're in the car, you've got a bullet in your arm, and you're like, oh my god, I'm finally out of Detroit. And then you just drive forward a few miles, and the sign says, Welcome to Detroit.
Oh god,
it's like, you know you're never getting out.
Like a Groundhog Day before like a location.
Yes. Is this an episode of Twilight Zone? Like, I
don't know. Oh, that's good.
You're tempting me to go off on a rant about the Twilight Zone. I'll refrain. And get back to bass and talk about Jan Jelinek. So yeah. This is guys making minimal techno. We talked about this guy Mono Lake last month, who made a great album of ambient dub techno. This is just really, really good. This was, by the way, this was like one of the top four albums of the month on the website. So people really do like this one. So again, if you don't listen to a lot of techno, techno is like a very plodding, high BPM music, and it's kind of right in your face. It's just so relentless in its beat. And I think what a lot of producers, especially here, are trying to do is put the beat further back and create atmosphere, create soundscapes. So that way, when the beat is there, it's not so oppressive. You kind of get to enjoy it as, you know, as it's the rest of the sound is washing over you. And so that way that it's not just simply about applying something so simple as just hitting you in the face with the loudest beat you can, you know, or the biggest bass you can. So that's what this record does, and because of that, it simultaneously is a very kinetic record. It's very uplifting when you listen to it. It kind of gets you motivated and moving, but also doesn't feel too overbearing. It's just kind of nice to listen to. So that's that. You have then the Knife, the K-N-I-F-E. They released their self-titled album. This is a Swedish duo. They make electronic pop music. They're going to have two of the biggest indie records of the 2010s, like of 2000 to 2010. They're going to have two really huge records come out that will be lauded and loved by fans and critics alike. This is a really rough debut. The opener, and this totally fooled me because the opener is a really pretty song and I liked it. And I'm like, oh, I'm in for a treat. The first Knife record's going to be good. And then I'm reminded of how weird they can be about things. It's not nearly as rough as like this Scottish band Life Without Buildings, but It's hard to get through, honestly. And the woman that sings, she's got a crazy voice too.
Yeah, it's so. The same girl, right?
Well, they got into that feud. There was like that Australian band they got into a feud with.
Did they?
They released like a response album called "That's Not a Knife."
Oh,
I hate you so much.
I actually did have a note here to bring up that, by the way, we did talk about a band called Spoon earlier.
Oh shit!
Now we're talking about the Knife.
that's a double feature.
I don't have a band called The Fork or Forks or anything like that. It would have been sweet.
Mm.
But yeah.
Oh, but man. Sporks.
Yeah. The most essential of utensils.
Yeah. So they'll figure it out in the future. But as of right now, the self-titled Knife album is just, I don't think you should listen to it. Ladytron released an album called 604. This is another band that was really big at the time, making electronic pop music. I didn't really enjoy this record either all that much because it is a long record. It's just this kind of, this woman's got kind of a wispy voice, and she's singing over these really loud, deathy organs. Organ sound that's on top of these very, I don't know, basic sounding electronic pop beats. The album never connected with me, and every record on here I listened through at least two or three times. I'm sure I gave this record its fair shot, and it just never really connected.
Don't hear a whole lot of organs anymore.
Yeah, it's it really creates this kind of gothic soundscape, but the rest of the music is just too bright that it's weird when they did that, or why they did that. I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce this name. It's either Labradford or LeBradford.
Let's go with LeBradford.
I like that, LeBradford.
I had never heard of this, but the album's called Fixed Context. Love it. It's a minimal ambient record. Just the first track is like 18 minutes long, and then there's maybe four or five other songs on there that are like 5 to 6 minutes long. Really, really beautiful if you like ambient music. Again, there's going to be no percussion anywhere to be found. It is just all layered, which sounds to me like organic instrumentation, kind of just coming and going in waves. Just sounds very, very pretty. I love it. Only thing is, and I don't know why they did this, because it really hurts the ears, but that first track that's like 18 minutes long, after probably the 16 minute mark of when the song stops being this blissfully beautiful thing, you just get feedback. You get like two minutes of just guitar, high-pitched squealing guitar feedback. I don't know why.
I mean, that is what you want.
Yeah. Just to kind of just bliss out to that, if you want, I guess.
It's like you got prep for the next song. It's like sniffing coffee beans in a perfume shop. I don't know why that analogy popped in my head.
What is that analogy? What are you talking about?
If you smell coffee beans, it takes air out of the other smells. Like a cleanser? Yeah, it's like a smell cleanser.
Like those little crackers they give you in wine tastings.
Or like a sorbet.
Yeah, or like a sorbet. Wow, all these things.
Yeah, it's like ginger when you're eating sushi.
Three other examples.
Like when you just brush your teeth and you drink orange juice.
No, not like that at all.
Like when you lick a battery. when you put the Switch cartridge in your mouth.
Oh, God. That is the worst. Oh.
Like when you wake up, you look over, and there's Gary Busey.
I did do that again. I keep forgetting about that Switch cartridge thing.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Gary Busey thing.
Yeah. Which, by the way, Ryan, can you tell them to stop showing up in my bedroom?
You had a wild night and woke up next to Gary Busey again.
Oh, gosh. Hey, you know, if I could, hey, as the song says, right, if you could frame him, it's the only way to keep him in one place.
Especially when he's all greased up.
I know, man, he is slippery. All right, one last ambient record, and oh my god, this is another just beast record. I love this. There's this guy, Patrick O'Hearn, released an album called So the Current Flows. This thing is just like, oh my god. It's like he recorded 10 different ambient albums all on one record. They all sound like the most beautiful cinematic score to a movie that doesn't exist. Like, it is just so fucking good. Oh my god. This has easily become my go-to listen. I'll just put this on all the time because I love hearing it. It evokes part of it feels like it could perfectly fit the soundtrack to like me playing Diablo 2. Like, I don't know if you guys know the Diablo 2 soundtrack, but all the different environments have these beautiful orchestrations. And this does the same thing. The way that he crafts these soundscapes is just gorgeous, and he uses all these different kinds of instrumentations. No two songs sound alike. And some of it is just like truly like just down and just simple ambient music that you can just bliss out to and enjoy. And there are other ones you just like, you feel the tribal percussion, and it's just like, it makes you feel like you're about to go into battle or something. I don't know. It's great. Three metal records, and then we're done. We're done. Almost done, you guys. Moon Sorrow released an album called Sudan Uni. This is a Finnish folk black metal band, and again, like I've told you guys, if it's folk metal, it's probably going to be bad. This album is pretty bad, at least in my opinion. I don't enjoy
waiting for like this album's amazing. Like, I was waiting for it.
No. This one is again, I don't want the, you know, you make a heavy record and then you're like, why don't we just put a fucking accordion in there? You know, again, it's
oh yeah, weird.
Yeah, it's just bizarre. It clashes violently with the music they're making. And, like, I don't know. Again, it's like people like those sea shanties. I almost feel like, do people enjoy this for this purely for the sake of irony? Like, I don't know.
Probably.
How, like, unless you, like, care about Finnish folk music, what do you really take away from this? And then if you do like Finnish folk music, what's your take on black metal? And are you happy that that's there? Like, oh my god.
And what's your take on Finnish people? Like, they're like a less attractive version of Sweden and Norway. Like, why fuck Finland? Is where I'm going with this.
I can see that. I mean,
this is like a random thing to have an opinion on, like the Finland people and just Finland in general. Like, fuck them. Like, it's Finland. Who gives a shit?
I think of all the Scandinavian countries, they're objectively the worst.
I mean, does it matter?
No, not a bit.
It's such a weird opinion. I don't mean anything. See, I know you're joking and you don't actually mean it, but it's just so far out there to me. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I got nothing. Whatever.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, Finland, I kind of agree, though. Something seems sketchy about them.
But fuck them anyways.
Yeah. You know what, John? We have a large listener base in Denmark, and this is really going to make them happy.
Sides. Fuck Finland.
All right, so Thorns, a band called Thorns, released their self-titled. This is also their only record, but it's just because the guy behind it is very prolific. This is a band from Norway. I'll tell you.
A great Scandinavian country.
Yeah, there you go, because they're the ones that brought us our beloved black metal band, Mayhem, right? And believe it or not, the drummer for Mayhem, who had just released an album a few months prior, The Grand Declaration of War, he is the drummer and singer for this project.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so he's back at it, man, and he is going. This is a very brutal black metal record. This is like an in-your-face kind of black metal record. The guitars have this buzzsaw sound to them. They're just really loud and harsh and over everything. And then behind it, I don't even think this is a real person drumming. It sounds like a drum machine. It's just that machine gun driven. This is a brutal, tough as nails record. I think it's good if you like that, if you're looking for that. Yeah, Thorns, the self-titled, it'll really it'll do some things to you.
What's your opinion about Switzerland?
You know, they were cool, but then they were hiding all that Nazi gold.
Yeah, I think I just don't understand what drives a man to be neutral.
It's such a beige place.
Those timepieces they make, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they have chocolates there.
Yeah, they make some candy.
Skiing is a thing that happens.
Yeah, you can generally, like, I'd be totally cool with Switzerland, but, you know, a little too cozy with them Nazis.
Yeah.
Get your act together, Switzerland.
Unforgivable. Yeah. Last album. Oh my god, you guys, we're almost done. A band called Soilwork. Soilwork is Danish. I guess that makes them from Denmark.
Yep, sure does. Another fine Scandinavian country.
They released an album called A Predator's Portrait. I don't know what that's about, but that's what they chose to call the record. This is great. It's a melodic death
metal.
What
kind of predator?
From the film. It's just a landscape.
Oh.
That would be great if it was like a yearbook photo of the Predator.
he's got his suit. He's got his bow tie.
Oh my god. I want to go back and like edit an old yearbook. Oh my. Of a Predator.
But hopefully they made him do the fake smile thing.
Like his weird mandibles all extended.
Oh. Adorable. No, yeah.
So, like, have like pictures of him on the soccer team next to Adrian Brody.
Yeah. So, I think this record is actually pretty solid. This is a real surprise. I dug it. It's a melodic death metal. It's just, what's like about it? It's propulsive. It sounds really good. The production's great. Drummer's really good. Tons and tons of riffs. And when they're not riffs, they're shredding. The vocals sound really good. It's also a good mix of that kind of death metal growling and yelling. With some melodic stuff in there without ever coming off as being too soft, because if you're making death metal, you don't want to be too soft.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's a really, really good band. Soilwork had made, I think, three albums part of this, and they're going to make like fucking 20 more. They're kind of a staple of the death metal scene. And this is finding them at their best, frankly, because some of their future material will not be so mean-spirited, and I think that they're better when they're doing harder stuff. So that's it. That's nice. That is a great month of music. Wow, wow, wow. A lot of good stuff.
What a time.
Oof.
Wes, give me one more European nation.
Europe?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
How's about Portugal?
Portugal. You know, why not just be part of Spain? Just join the club. Yeah, you might as well.
What about Spain?
Spain, generally, A-okay.
Try to be more Spanish. Ireland? Why are our Spanish people more Spanish than Spain?
Right. You know what? I will say this. Spain, generally positive. We have more Spanish speakers in America than they have in Spain. So they need to step up their game and make some more Spaniards.
But they do have the bowl thing.
Yeah, they have like domesticated animals that they run from. It's yep. probably not terrifying. It's probably just like, here comes some cows, look out.
But then they brutally murder them.
I think yeah, and then they like they murder the cows, which you know we do too. But hopefully, you know.
But yeah, we don't make them run around for us beforehand.
We don't give them that taste of freedom. We murder them. Oh,
shit. That would be, you know, and that's the kind of cruelty that you would expect from the American penal system. That we would make them before they get electrocuted, like run 2 miles. The last thing that they do before they die is like to run.
We tell someone you're being executed by firing squad, but don't tell them where the squad is. So just like unblindfold them in a field somewhere and they kind of look around like, oh shit, oh shit. Executions are funny.
Wow.
We've been going for a long time.
Yeah.
So, next up is going to be the official show. We got lots of cool stuff to talk about in the official show.
Nice.
Lots of things going on. A little bit of news here and there, but, you know, we got some new games. Some of them, like, bigger AAA, but we got some smaller indie games that are going to be fun to talk about. And we saw a movie. We saw a new release movie. That's going to be a great time to discuss, because, oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, this movie. But, yeah. And then we'll start it all up again in March with the Pokemon show.
Mm.
That's it, the end.
So long.
Sayonara.
Hold my gun.